Before we dive into today's episode, I just wanted to let you know about a podcast that we've been listening to here at Circ Migration, the Migration Podcast, produced by our good friends at Amisco. You may have noticed that we featured an episode with Alejandra Diaz de Leon last week. In it, Alejandra reflects about how the journey of Central American migrants walking north through Mexico is about much more than just having practical strategies to survive. If you didn't get a chance to listen, I highly recommend that you check it out. You'll find the Migration Podcast on all the major platforms. Now on to our show. Welcome to Borders and Belonging, a podcast that explores regional migration issues in a global context. This series is produced by Circ Migration in collaboration with LEAD Podcasting. I'm Maggie Pajina, a researcher with the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Migration and Integration Program at Toronto Metropolitan University. Did you know that the Middle East boasts the world's highest ratio of migrants to its national population? In this episode, we're exploring the Middle East's labor migration phenomenon, where economic migration and forced displacement have led to the formation of a remarkably interconnected regional labor market. This labor migration isn't just a footnote. It's a dynamic economic force that has far-reaching consequences. Remittances sent home by migrant workers here exceed the value of regional trade in goods and official capital flows, revealing the crucial role of migrants in the region's financial landscape. The story of migration in the Middle East is one of evolution. Historically, it walked hand in hand with the development of the oil economy, spurring the need for support workers. But today, the Middle East's economic ambitions reach far beyond oil. We'll dive deep into how these changing economies are reshaping the character of regional migration, as countries in the Gulf increasingly focus on nurturing knowledge-based economies. In a moment, two esteemed researchers will help us unravel the threads between migration and regional politics, exploring the impacts on both migrants and host nations. But first, we'll speak with Deepak Unnikrishnan. He's a writer and an assistant arts professor of literature and creative writing at NYU Abu Dhabi. In a labor camp somewhere in the Persian Gulf, a laborer swallowed his passport and turned into a passport. His roommate swallowed a suitcase and turned into a little suitcase. So begins the first chapter of Deepak Unnikrishnan's book, Temporary People. If it sounds surreal to you, don't worry, that's kind of the point.
It is essential for the book to be real and surreal and unreal for everything to make sense. So I've had critics who've looked at the book who say, you know, this doesn't make any sense because of the way human beings behave and how you write about them. But it also makes a lot of sense because this feels like the Gulf. That felt true to what I understood the Gulf was, particularly the city I come from, Abu Dhabi. The first line in my bio is, Deepak Unnikrishnan is from Abu Dhabi.
Deepak was born and raised in Abu Dhabi. And while his family has roots in Kerala, India, their connections to the Gulf go back three generations.
We have history here. When I say we, every male member of my mother's side and father's side of the family has lived in the Gulf, you know, in some way, shape, or form, or has worked in the Gulf in some way, shape, or form.
Deepak's family originally migrated to the region for work, the same motivation that's led millions of others there since the 1950s oil boom. But Deepak doesn't want to contribute to the narrative that simply paints them as laborers and nothing more. He wants to shed light on the individuals, each with their own histories, dreams, and challenges that call the Gulf home.
I think the book at the end of the day is also looking at characters who are wedded to occupation because that's what the Gulf has become. You can't enter the Gulf as someone who's not from the Gulf if you're not wedded to occupation or a tourist visa. That is what the system is. That is the policy. So you're always, your experience is attached to your work or tourist visa, period. So in other words, if you're writing about the Gulf, that's what you're going to see. That's what you're going to ingest, digest. And I guess I'm also making a not so subtle point that because you have all of these individuals who show up from so many places, who work certain gigs, what would their stories be?
With each chapter of Temporary People, we hear what some of these stories might be, like the man who uses a magical phone to teleport to his wife, the taxi driver who gives unsolicited advice to wealthy clients in Hindi, or the woman who spends her days duct taping injured construction workers back together. These are not direct accounts of people Deepak knows per se, but they are rooted in the world that he and his family grew up in, one with a diversity of languages, cultures, and occupations.
From my father's and mother's side of the family, every male member of their immediate, even extended family, has lived or worked in the Gulf. So they've worked working class jobs, they've worked white collar jobs, and it's possible some of them may have worked pink collar jobs. So it's familiar. Was my father a taxi driver? No. But at the same time, there's something else to sort of consider here, which would be language. I grew up speaking Malayalam at home. I went to an Indian community school where English was the lingua franca. And then in the taxi cabs, it would be Urdu or maybe Hindi. So these languages gave me access to a backstory, which I've always been familiar with. So I just wanted to sort of incorporate that into what the work is. The book, if you sort of treat the book as a book about labor, that would be inaccurate. I think at the end of the day, the book is a book about the Gulf.
When asked why he chose to write this book as fiction, Deepak explains that to him, he sees fiction as a tool that will give him more freedom to write, uncensored, than nonfiction would.
Because this is a hyper-surveillance state. And so if you want access to the people that you'd like to write about, most often you're not going to get them. I also think about the ethics of that transaction. Because if I'm going to put someone at risk because I want to have a conversation with them, write about them, I don't feel too great about that.
Ultimately, Deepak hopes that Temporary People will serve as an homage to a region where stories, memories, and legacies are at risk of being disrupted by migration and movement.
So we have to sort of figure out a different way to think about our stories and not only think about them, take it elsewhere. The usual narrative or the usual way of doing this would be to know that you're located in the place for a while. You may die there. You may have children who will die there, and they will carry your stories forward. You're not going to get that in the Gulf. So when you're not going to get that in the Gulf, what do you do when you eventually have to leave, or if you do leave? And this is something that I think about. And I think that's what makes our position I wouldn't say unique, just different.
Many thanks to Deepak Unnikrishnan for sharing the backstory of his book, Temporary People. The Gulf region is dependent on migrant labor to fill the gaps in its workforce. So this shift to a knowledge-based economy has ripple effects for those migrating to the region. Joining me to discuss this are Laure Assaf and Helene Thwale. Laure is an anthropologist and a specialist in Middle Eastern studies at NYU Abu Dhabi. Helene is a research fellow at the French National Center for Scientific Research, Sciences Po. Her research focuses on migration policies in the countries of the South, with particular interest in the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Let's look at some context first. Helene, could you tell me about the historical correlation between the growth of migrant labor and the development of the oil economy in the Middle East?
Well, the two are, of course, neatly connected. And the story of immigration and migrant labor in the region starts in the early 30s. With the first oil boom, that is to say, the discovery of oil in the region under colonial rule for most GCC countries, except for Saudi Arabia, that was not colonized by the British Empire. But still, it's the moment when the first explorations of oil in the region lead to different kinds of mobility. Mobility within the regions of national, of Gulf sheikhdoms, from non-oil to oil eras, the mobility of inhabitants of the rest of the British Empire, notably the subcontinent, the British Raj, coming to the Gulf to work in the emerging oil industry. And the third kind of mobility is the mobility of British and American skilled expatriates, such as engineers and managers who came to work in the region. The second period starts in the 1960s and opens onto what was termed the second oil boom, which is also a migration boom, culminating with the 1973 nationalization of the oil industries across the regions, which led to the increase of oil prices and a substantial increase also in the number of people coming to work in the oil industry. So the second period opens in the 1960s with the second oil boom, which is really, you know, culminating in 1973, the increase in the oil prices and the increase in the sector in the region, also leading to increase in labor import to the region. The third sequence starts in the 1990s. It's really a post-colonial and also most modern phase of the industrial development in the region, which leads to a diversification of the economy. So it's not just about oil, it's also about the service industry, it's also about tertiary sectors that grow and lead to renewed immigration waves to the region.
Laure, anything to add?
Yeah, I think, you know, building on what Hélène has just said, what happened with the beginning of oil exploitation is a restructuration of migration flows. They grew in intensity, but migration to the Gulf did not start with oil, right? The Arabian Peninsula has been historically shaped by the circulation of people and of goods throughout the region.
Hélène, you've introduced the concept of migration diplomacy to describe political integration in the region. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it's interesting to look at international relations focusing on the management of migration from this particular region where population movement have been so important for such a long time. As Laure said, mobility has always been a very political issue in the region. So, for instance, we didn't mention previously the fact that the pilgrimages to the holy sites of Islam, Mecca and Medina, have always drawn a lot of people to the Arabian Peninsula. And this has been regulated by diplomatic relations between countries of origins of the pilgrims and Saudi Arabia or the rulers of the area before the creation of the country itself. So this is just an example of how historical the management, the political management of population is, even when we're not talking about oil-related migration. Now, when we're talking about oil-related migration, it has been also very neatly regulated by the British Empire across the various colonies. For instance, the Aramco in Saudi Arabia, which itself organized labor import with countries of origin. And nowadays, countries of the GCC are also tying diplomatic relations with countries of origin to ensure the flows of incoming workers, but also constrain the rights and the ability of these incoming workers and their family to settle in the Gulf. So the political dimension of migration in this region is often underestimated, looking only at economic factor, but it's in fact extremely important.
With the high levels of expatriates in the Gulf, what are the factors driving such a high ratio of migrants to the national populations? Laure?
So in the smaller Emirates like Qatar and the UAE, the ratio of migrants is very high. It's in the UAE around 88%, and it reaches 90% in the main urban centers in Dubai, for example. And so about the factors driving this this high ratio, as Hélène was mentioning, migration was first seen as a necessity by the nascent Gulf states as part of the state building and urban development that was taking place after the beginning of oil exploitation. Also with the increase in income that was fostered by the oil booms of the 70s that created both the means and the demand for labor. So it was first about bringing in the workforce and the skills necessary to build these cities and to build the new states. At the same time, these migrants were in majority kept separated from the national population in the sense that there was very little formal incorporation. And there's no systematic process of naturalization in most Gulf countries. And so the idea was this workforce was going to come and help build these cities and then go home. But at the same time, migrants' presence also became, we could say, structurally embedded in the ways these Gulf societies function. There's a situation of dependence on migrant labor from the home itself and through the work of domestic workers to teachers in schools, but also increasingly to a consumer market that is now largely composed of these migrant workers. Since at least the 1980s, this huge presence of foreign residents has been constructed as a public issue in many of these Gulf countries, at the level of the state because of concerns around national security, but also the competition of migrants with nationals on the labor market with rising rates of unemployment in the national population, but also at the sort of more social scale because of conflicts around social norms. For example, intermarriages are often portrayed in the media as a threat to the national identity of the local populations.
Just to, I mean, to add to the very complete account that Laure gave, the situation in Saudi Arabia is a bit one of a kind in the region. It's the largest country with the largest population. So it also has a large population of nationals among the resident of Saudi Arabia. And it also has maybe a bit more of a diverse resident population with various social classes among Saudis. And so we have socioeconomic diversity among the Saudi population, so poor Saudis, middle-class Saudis, as well as richer classes, which echoes the diversity of the non-Saudi population. So this mix we find less in smaller states in the region, and the ratio of foreigners to national is about 1 to 4 person. But there's similar issues and concern for dependency upon foreign labor and protection of cultural and ethnic identity of Saudi Arabia are politicized in Saudi Arabia.
How are the efforts to transition towards a knowledge economy impacting the nature of labor migration in the Gulf region? Laure?
Yeah, so the question of the transition towards a knowledge economy is sort of now a recurring keyword in all the economic, social, and political visions that are put forward by the Gulf rulers, I would say at least since the turn of the 21st century. And it's often portrayed in these plans as part of the preparation of the post-oil era, something that is going to lead economic diversification that will allow to alleviate the dependency on oil revenues. One thing to note, though, is that it happens along different timelines at the regional scale, but also even at the national scale. In the UAE, for example, Dubai has engaged in this diversification long before Abu Dhabi because of its relatively smaller oil resources. And so one thing that both Hélène and I have been working on is that while there were before sort of hierarchies of migrant labor based on skill were already salient before the kafala system, which was the main mode of governance of migrants' presence in the Gulf. It's a system that took widely different shapes depending on one's nationality, gender, occupation, race, etc. But these hierarchies of skill have become more visible and more explicit in the policies adopted by these governments today. So, for example, Gulf countries have made it very clear that they are welcoming investors and skilled workers, and very often they specify certain fields. In the case of the UAE, they started attributing golden visas that are long-term visas sponsored directly by the state in specific fields like science, engineering, healthcare, etc. Maybe another important thing to note here is that these hierarchies of skill also intersect with hierarchies of nationality and race. This has been well studied by scholars like Amélie Le Renard and Neha Vora. And for example, in the labor market, on the one hand, these policies are turned towards recruiting investors, skilled workers, etc. On the other hand, academic degrees and work experience from the West, and especially from Europe and North America, are much more valued on this labor market, sometimes even to the detriment of national population and of other migrant communities that have a more historical presence in the Gulf.
Helen, Laura mentioned the kafala system. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, the kafala system is the local form of migration intermediation, which has been institutionalized largely under colonial rules in the region, so under the British rule of the Gulf countries. The kafala works as followed. In order to enter one of the Gulf countries and to get a visa and a work permit, which is the condition for obtaining a visa, you need to have a local sponsor who is either a person or a corporate entity. And so it ties the presence and residence of foreigners in the Gulf countries to a national or a national entity. So it's a relationship of dependency in exchange of a fee that sort of commodifies and privatizes the management of migration. Now, of course, the kafala system had various forms across sectors of the economy. It also varies across space in rural and urban areas, and it has changed over time. What we've been observing in the past two decades is what I called a governmentalization of the kafala system. That is to say, nation states and governments have been increasingly trying to bring back this privatized governance of migration into governmental agency and to try and better control using the state apparatus migration. And so there is basically a tension of both cooperation and a bit of competition between the kafala system, which is a sort of delegation of migration politics to society and the market, and the state effort to better control migration.
As economic migration and forced displacement shape a highly integrated regional labor market, what challenges and opportunities does this present for Gulf nations? Laura?
So one thing we can note here is that Gulf states have very flexible migration policies. And there's also what Adam Hani, for example, has called a spatial dimension to this migrant labor force. That is, these policies often sort of move according to what we could call a global labor market. A labor market that is very segmented, and so very often specific jobs or specific occupations are recruited from specific places. It's especially the case for low-income jobs that often sort of target specific nationalities, which is in part a factor of historical migration trends, but which also has evolved to include, let's say, new economic developments at the global scales, depending on labor supply, right? One example of that is that after the economic crisis in Nepal, certain sectors like construction or taxi drivers started recruiting more and more workers from this country. And today in the UAE, many taxi drivers are from the African continent, Uganda, Cameroon, etc. So this targeted recruitment evolves depending on this specialized global labor market.
To complement this a bit, the changing histories of migration also go together with changing geographies. During the colonial era, in you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, until the decolonization process in the 70s, immigrants coming from the subcontinent, from India, from Pakistan, but also from other Asian countries under British control, were largely dominant in the region. And then after, in the 60s and in the 70s, and after decolonization, there was a strong push for bringing in Arab workers to the GCC as a token of post-colonial and regional integration among Arab countries. So there was a very, very strong political dimension to the immigration of Arab workers and their family to the GCC. We can see that particularly with the presence of large number of Palestinians, for instance, who settled in the Gulf after the creation of Israel and throughout the 60s and the 70s with the different wars that happened in Israel. And then migration was used as a proxy for a sort of depoliticized asylum process for Palestinians. The situation nowadays is a bit different. Rather than political justifications behind the selection of immigrants from particular countries, we see the Gulf operating along strategies of diversification. So the different Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Qatar, trying to diversify the origin of their expatriate communities to be less dependent upon, say, India or the Philippines and Indonesia. And this was particularly triggered by the early 1990s crisis at the moment of the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. A lot of expatriates from Egypt, from Yemen, from India left Kuwait and showed the Gulf country how fragile they were when their expatriate community, you know, just left, and what kind of consequences this could have on their economy. So these strategies are actually driving a lot of the migration diplomacy we observe today. And in response, countries of origin like Indonesia or India or even Nepal or the Philippines are trying to also, you know, also show their strength and negotiate welfare conditions for their nationals in the Gulf, and trying also to enhance the level of protection of their national workers in the Gulf country, which is, as is well known, pretty low. I mean, the level of protection is pretty low.
Laure, you've written about cosmopolitanism in the Gulf. How do migrants fit into a social fabric of a country like the UAE or Saudi Arabia?
Thank you for this question. Actually, both Helen and I co-wrote on this very question. Maybe the first observation in response to how migrants fit into the social fabric is that there, to some extent, migrants are integrated in this fabric. I've mentioned earlier that there are no modes of formal incorporation of migrants, in the sense that there are no formal or systematic processes of naturalization in Gulf countries. But this is true today. This was not entirely true at the moment of creation of the states. And so there is actually an internal diversity of the national populations that is a result of the historical circulations that we discussed earlier in this podcast. There is a huge ethnic, racial, linguistic, and religious diversity of the citizenries. that is often obscured in official discourses today in the Gulf, that tend to present citizens as a homogeneous group, but that is also contested by a number of intellectuals, artists, writers, etc., that are pointing to this, but also ordinary citizens that are bringing forward this diversity. So that's the first point. The second point is that migrants are also not a homogeneous category. They are a category that is hugely diverse, and diverse segments of this category are treated differently by the Gulf states, or let's say enter very different types of relationship with the states. So at one end of this spectrum, you have these low-income migrants that I mentioned earlier that are very often people hired on short-term contracts, often with a maximum of 3 years, and who are expected to leave the country once their job is done. Although there have been reforms in recent years to make it easier to change employers while remaining in the country, etc., this is still not a very simple process. At the opposite end of that spectrum, you find whom you could call the global elites, who tend to have different residencies across the world, etc. But these are sort of the two polarized group. In between, you have a much larger segment of the migrant population that could be called diverse middle classes, right? That occupy a range of positions and have very different modes of integration into these urban societies. For example, a lot of my work has been looking at young Arabs, both Emiratis and Arab expatriates who grew up in Abu Dhabi and were coming of age in the 2010s. And these are, a large part of this group were second, third, sometimes fourth generation to live in the Gulf. They were often children of parents who had been working in the public sector in Abu Dhabi, who had gone to public schools with Emirati students whose friend groups were very diverse within this Arab population, and who had very similar practices of the city, etc. Another important observation is that many of the assumptions that we make when we think about migrant integration is that migrants are the minority group that is integrating into a dominant group that's the majority of the population and that's overlapping with the citizen population. But the Gulf sort of disrupts these assumptions because nationals are not a majority of the population, at least not in all Gulf countries. Whether or not they're the dominant group can be debated at many, many levels. And so one thing I've been trying to argue throughout my work is that both migrants and citizens, in a sense, have to integrate into these diverse urban environments.
Helene, can you discuss any specific policies or initiatives that Saudi Arabia or other Gulf nations have implemented to facilitate this transition to a knowledge economy and manage the effects of migration patterns?
Going back at what Laure said earlier, I think one of the striking features of migration policies in the past decade is the increased selection of migrants based on their skills and also the differential allocation of rights, notably right to family reunion, right to long-term residence, according to skills or social class. So let me explain. Basically, it's the idea that migration governance and migration politics is becoming increasingly class-based in the region. People with high social capital, high skills, and corresponding to what others have called talent migration will be given rights to settle, rights to bring their family and to participate to some sort of an integration. While low-skilled workers, for instance, in Saudi Arabia, workers were allowed to bring their family, whatever their skill level, until recently. And some years ago, a tax was introduced that asked foreign workers to pay a flat tax on the resident permits of their family members. And by having a flat tax, you see what the outcome is. For someone who doesn't earn a lot of money, say a taxi driver from Pakistan, paying so much for his wife and his children is going to represent a large share of his income, as opposed to someone who earns a lot of money, say a surgeon in a hospital, and for whom the flat tax will not represent a large share of his income, and oftentimes is being included in a sort of salary package. So here you see that this class-based differential treatment of migrants when it comes to their rights to live with their family, to settle long-term, is introducing something which is relatively new in Saudi Arabia, but has been existing for much longer time in the UAE, in Qatar, and other countries. And I see this as a sort of return of a very Marxist class-based differentiation treatment of the labor force.
Yeah, I think, you know, Helen has very well explained how the main consequence of this transition is essentially the reshaping of migration policies along the lines of social class, wealth, and skill. And these are, of course, very overlapping or intersecting categories. There have been numerous ways through which this shift has been illustrated in policies, with many Gulf countries implementing reforms to the kafala system, notably through the use of longer-term visas, like the golden visas that were famously brought forward by the UAE a few years ago, that are meant to encourage certain categories of migrants to remain in the country. At the same time, I would say that some segments of the migrant population, especially within these middle classes that I was discussing, have been able to sort of use these reforms to their advantage. In particular, those second or third generation who have had a form of, I would say, educational mobility or class mobility by comparison to their parents, so who were able, growing up in the UAE, to be educated abroad, come back with a better passport and sort of take some of these now highly favored jobs.
Helen, looking to the future and the evolving economic landscape and changing migration patterns, how do you think the political landscape to the Gulf region will be shaped by these changes?
Thank you for this question. It actually is a quite difficult one. The question may be understood, I think, in two ways. Is migration impacting political trajectories in the Gulf? And to what extent the political trajectories of the Gulf will be severely reshaping migration patterns? For the first understanding of this question, I think that actually this long history of immigration to the region has impacted the history of societies and of politics. It has, but in a way that have not changed the rather illiberal nature of migration governance in the region, and the fact that rights are still not available for most foreigners in these regions, even though they are born in these countries, they remain foreigners and have a hard time accessing naturalization except on exceptional circumstances. So there is an impact, but it doesn't translate into formal policy. The impact of the presence of long-term foreign population is something that you see more on the grounds at the city level through the kind of ethnographic observation Laura and myself have been conducting. What we see, Laura and I, through ethnographic observation is that on the grounds in urban neighborhood, you see interactions and integrations between second and third generation of people from migrant origin integrated into local societies, especially in this diverse middle class that Law was describing. But at both ends of the socioeconomic spectrum, among the poorer segment of societies and the richest, of course, the segregation is very, very high. Now, turning to the second part of the question, or the second understanding of the question, basically, are the political changes observed at the top of the GCC states going to reshape entirely migration patterns. Well, we already mentioned that there was an attempt to diversify the origin of incoming migrants in the past decades, but still what we observe in national statistics is the overwhelming weight of immigration from the subcontinent, from India and from Pakistan, in most of the smaller GCC states. And so the ability to diversify origin of immigrants and migration geographies is actually very limited by a sort of path dependencies of economies, of economic networks and social networks. And it sort of shows the resilience and resistance of migration as a social process to the authoritarian ruling imposed by states.
Laure, what do you see looking to the future?
I fully second what Helen just said, in the sense, first, that it's indeed very difficult to predict what's going to happen, also because a lot of these policies have changed very rapidly in the previous years. So it's hard to know what's going to come. I also second what Helen said, in the sense that I don't think there's going to be sort of deep changes in sort of not migration policies, as we've discussed, but migration politics more generally in the Gulf, in the sense that there are clearly the forms of sort of longer term residence that are now offered to some categories of this migrant population, and this restructuration in terms of social class, skill and wealth are clearly not accompanied by forms of political participation or by further sort of formal integration of these foreigners into the states. I think if anything, what's more likely to transform, or what's already transforming as part of the transition to the knowledge economy and the process of economic diversification, is actually the relationship between the state and its citizens. And that's, these are processes that have happened maybe earlier in Gulf states that have larger citizen populations like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, and also that have national population that have a sort of a wider class differences across their national population. But that it's a process that we are witnessing very clearly now in the UAE, which is essentially a slow disengagement on the part of the state from the type of welfare that it was offering its citizens before. And that's translated, I've looked particularly at the youth, and this shift is translated in many injunctions to young Emiratis to join the private sector, for example, join specific fields in which the state is currently investing as part of this process of economic diversification. The sort of more typical or historical ways through which the state had redistributed the oil rent, which was through employment in the public sector and in the state's bureaucracy, is now portrayed in official discourse as sort of the easy path, and one that young citizens are not sort of encouraged to take anymore. They're rather encouraged towards the vocabulary that is being used now is that of entrepreneurship, innovation, etc. So I think it is in this relationship between the state and its population that we see most of these changes currently happening.
Thanks to Laure Assaf and Helen Thwale for joining me today. And thank you for listening. This is a CERC Migration podcast produced in collaboration with LEAD Podcasting. If you enjoyed the episode, subscribe to Borders and Belonging on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information on the Gulf region moving from an oil to a knowledge economy, please visit the show notes. I'm Maggie Pajana. Thanks for listening.